Our second case for this morning is Zanetti v. IKO Manufacturing. Mr. Sakharov.
Thank you, Your Honor. Samuel Sakharov for the appellants. Your Honor, this case involves one dominant issue, and that is whether the organic shingles that were sold by IKO conform to the industry standards. There is no dispute.
Mr. Sakharov, before we get too far into the merits of the class certification, I wonder whether Judge Baker had the authority to act on this issue at all. This case was assigned by the panel on multi-district litigation to Judge McCuskey. And as I read 28 U.S.C. 1407B, the panel chooses the judge. District court can't override the panel's decision. That appears to be what happened here. The district court, all on its own, reassigned this matter to Judge Baker. So the question I have is, was Judge Baker acting ultra vires?
Your Honor, that's a very troubling question, and one that has bothered me since I became involved in this case. I agree with you that under the MDL statute, there is not the power to reassign. This is not a transfer to a district. This is an assignment to a particular judge. In the interim, and this is an unprecedented occurrence in my knowledge, the MDL panel has subsequently assigned the case to Judge Baker.
It was assigned to Judge Baker in February 2014 after he entered the order that is now under review.
I agree with Your Honor on that. This is extremely troubling, and I believe that Judge Baker did not have the authority at the time that he acted to act on this matter pursuant to an intra-district transfer by a fellow judge or by the senior, the presiding judge in the district.
Then the next question is, should we understand the panel's February 2014 order as having retroactive effect, as having validated what Judge Baker had done when he was not lawfully presiding?
Your Honor, I think that we would end up in a circle here because
it's always a worry every time somebody raises a problem of ultra vires, because you send it to somebody who's authorized to act, he might do the same thing.
And in this case, the judge who is currently authorized to act is the exact same judge, and one would presume that he would enter the exact same order and that we would be back here in 6 months or whenever this court could hear us. So I would encourage the court to reach the merits of the certification, where I think we should prevail, because if not, we're just going to go through this, I fear, again, because there is no question at this point in my mind, and I hope in the court's mind, that the February 2014 order did in fact assign the case to Judge Baker properly, and that's where we are now.
So you're essentially arguing you think this is a matter of case processing that can be overlooked or fixed somehow, as opposed to a jurisdictional level problem?
Judge Wood, I wish I had a clean box to put this in. This is a mess. It shouldn't have been done this way. That's clear. The parties didn't raise it below. Nobody tendered an objection to Judge
Baker. Nobody pointed this out to the panel for 4 years.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. My tenure in this case is short, but I have looked back and I cannot find any record of anybody having made any such recommendation until at such time as the chief judge took senior status.
Do you think that's what prompted them to go back to the panel?
As best I can tell, Judge Wood, I just don't know. I don't have any evidence in the record on that issue, and I don't have any representations from any lawyers as to how this came about. So I'm at a loss on this one, and as best I can tell, there's no law that guides us on what to do in this circumstance. But the case is currently before Judge Baker. There's every reason to presume that this would be the controlling opinion of Judge Baker if he were asked Again, although maybe we could take another crack at it below and make some arguments based upon Butler all over again, but that's where we are. If this court were to rule that it were ultra vires, then we would go back and re-urge Judge Baker. But in
case, why don't you proceed with your argument for the time being, since here you are, and we know what this issue is.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So as I was saying at the beginning, we think that this is a case that's controlled by one central issue, and the question is whether the shingles at sold by IKO conform to the representation that was made. There's no dispute that every single shingle sold by IKO came in a wrapper, and inside on that wrapper it said it was D225 compliant. D225 is a term of art in the industry. It is the highest level of certification of organic shingles by the trade association that is responsible for this. D225 compliance turns out to be critical in the market. As our expert testified at the Daubert hearing, in order to be available for use in most jurisdictions in the United States, organic shingles must meet D225 compliance.
If they are local building codes?
Local building codes and also trade regulations. So, and also practices of some big chain stores and so forth. They will not carry them without that compliance. We submit that the controlling issue in this case is, were these shingles in fact D225 compliant?
And now, do you conceptualize this as a C4 kind of issue, or do you see this as simply a predominant, you know, a common issue of fact and law, for that matter?
Your Honor, I think it's both. I think that on the C4 question, the court below simply disregarded the unbroken line of cases of this court over the past decade, beginning with Metcoil and Allen in 2003 and 2004, and running through most notably the Butler decision of last year. I think that in addition, the court got hung up on how the damages would be calculated and thought that that was an obstacle to certification. It turns out that under industry custom, there is a simple formula that's used for damages calculation when shingles fail, when roofing fails.
So and your argument would be, I mean, looking at the second point identified in Comcast, that the damages resulting are measurable on a class-wide basis through use of a common methodology.
Yes, I think the district court erred in confusing that statement in Comcast with identity of damages and no intervening events on any individual claimant. And I think that is absolutely wrong as a matter of Seventh Circuit law, given Butler and given the issue class cases in this court. But we submit that, in fact, this case was ripe for B3 certification on its terms, because under industry conventions, the failure of a roof leads to a calculation, which is how many square feet, what jurisdiction, broken down by area code, by zip code, do you live in? There's a number of objective factors that are used.
Is the composition of the shingle the primary issue, or the method of installation, or?
Well, Your Honor, we think that there are three different questions. The first is this D225 compliant? And that turns on both the procedural and a substantive compliance with industry standards. And then the third question is whether there are offsetting factors, whether there are mitigating circumstances that might reduce the damages in any individual case. Let me address the first two, if I may. Under the industry standards, there are two requirements for D225 certification. The first is a procedural one. In order to be certified under D225, you had to go through the proper protocol test, which is called D228 under the standards. There is no dispute in the record that none of these shingles was submitted to D228 testing. None. And in fact, if one reads the entire record of this case, what happens is this is uncovered at a deposition, and it comes as a shock to the plaintiffs, because they could not believe that a major company like IKO would simply say it's D225 compliant and never have tested it for that, even though that's the first requirement, and their 30B6 witness, their expert, everyone confirms no testing was ever done. So on that score, they are out. The second part of D225 compliance is substantive. Is there a certain density to the mass? Is there a certain coating? All these sorts of things. Now, their argument, and they have a big blow-up that they waved around the district court, their argument is essentially what Judge Posner once referred to as the serendipity theory, that even though they never tested, somehow, you know, miracles of miracles, it conformed. And our expert went through and tested them and found that in over 90% they did not conform. Now, their argument is going to be, was below, and I assume it's going to be here, on most of the factors, most of them complied, some as much as 99%, some as much as a third. But D225 protocols under the industry standards are not do the best you can, come as close as you can. It is not pick a few of these factors and conform to those. You must conform to all of them to pass. It is links in a chain. You cannot leave the undercoating out. You cannot have not enough mass. And our experts said that the types of harms which are typically seen in the roofs that he inspected are consistent with the failures under D228. Now, there may be mitigating circumstances. Some might badly install the shingles, no doubt. Some houses may be destroyed in a tornado, no doubt. Any of those things can happen. But that's the same issue this court addressed in Pell, where it said that installation and other intervening factors may compromise the windows. Nonetheless, if the windows as sold were nonconforming, that's the harm. And this court, on several occasions, most notably a year ago in the Anchor Mortgage case, said that the basic measure of harm is if you paid to get X, but you got Y, and Y is inferior, that harm, the delta, that difference, is your harm. And the same thing that the court said 15 years ago in the Teamsters versus Philip Morris case. Again, if you pay too much to get inferior goods, you are harmed. Our claim here is very standard UCC claim. Count 4 of the complaint says there's a breach of contract.
I'm not sure what that theory of damages does to particular claims. If the theory of damages is that everybody who buys it gets the difference between a D225 tile and whatever it was they bought, that's just the market price difference, does it not follow from that that people whose tiles actually failed then get nothing extra? Everybody gets this difference. It wouldn't be actuarially correct for everybody to get the difference and the people whose tiles actually failed to get more. You could do one or the other. Either everybody gets epsilon or the people who fail get their actual loss. But you can't have both, it seems.
Your Honor, the complaint alleges both kinds of harms. It alleges the warranty harm and it alleges a straight breach of contract. The UCC actually provides for alternative bases of recovery on just the grounds you set forth. So one is under the measure of breach of damages for breach of warranty. Here I'm reading from UCC section 27142. The difference at the time and place of acceptance between the value of the goods accepted and the value they would have had if they'd been as warranted. Under UCC section 1-305, the claim is that you put the aggrieved party in as good a position as if the other party had fully performed. One is the warranty standard, one is the breach of contract standard. There is ambiguity in the case law as to which should control, but either one is a class-wide measure.
Is either one something that would be a common class-wide basis, common methodology? I'm trying to get a sense of what is at the class level and what you think pushes over to the individualized damage hearings.
I think the only question for individualized damage hearings is whether there were offsetting events.
So the tornado.
A tornado, a fire, installation that had clearly compromised the integrity of the shingles, those sorts of things. This is...
Why on the theory that everybody gets the difference in retail value, would a tornado matter?
It would not, Your Honor. It would not, Your Honor.
So it wouldn't be an offset.
It would not, Your Honor, but there is the risk that somebody who got effectively the benefit of the bargain. Now I'm on the UCC contract side rather than the UCC warranty side. There is the concern that if somebody got the benefit of the bargain, then they should be they should not get more than that. So if the roof happened to last the 20 years and they never had a problem with it, presumably they should not recover. Although,
why not?
Well, it Your Honor, I can't disagree with you on this because the UCC gives two distinct remedies for this. And
you can pick one. The fact that you don't get number two means you're not knocked out from number one.
Number one is likely to be lower for some people than
number
two.
Yes,
that
is lower, although in the aggregate for the whole class, number one and number two ought to be the same thing in aggregate.
That is correct.
Otherwise, somebody's not counting right.
That is absolutely right, Your Honor. If the market discounted perfectly for this risk, they should be the same. But under either theory, this is a class-wide definition of the harm. We are not here today arguing what is the superior UCC remedy when you have both a breach of contract and a breach of warranty case. What we're arguing is that everybody's in the same boat. They got sold tiles which were not as represented. This is the classic form of seller deceit. It's material. It has everything to do with why one buys it. And what's more, their own witness, Nancy Bateman, testified that this is what drives the market. People buy them because they are better quality. The better quality is reflected in the warranty, what presumably is the warranty. And Judge Baker unfortunately misunderstood that we were seeking to enforce a 20-25-year warranty rather than seeking the benefit of the bargain that we bought tiles which were supposed to be the gold medal under industry standards, and they weren't. They lied.
All right, your time is up, Mr. Sackrop. So thank you. Mr. Murphy.
May it please the Court. Good morning. Chris Murphy for the defendants. I want to address two key points this morning. First, the plaintiffs completely ignore the three key factual findings of the trial court that the issues of injury...
Before we get into merits, I want to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Azikarov. Did Judge Baker have the authority to render this decision? And it appears the answer is no. So what do we do about this apparently ultra vires act?
I can't answer the question whether there was that authority. I couldn't find any law on that issue either.
Oh, the law is perfectly straightforward. The statute says that the panel makes an assignment to a judge and that the court or the chief judge of the circuit can reassign it on the approval of the panel.
Okay. Well, Your Honor, what I was going to say is
it's perfectly
clear Judge Baker had no authority
to do what he did.
Okay. The reality of the situation was, why wasn't this issue raised as you asked counsel?
Well, that's an interesting question.
Well, and the answer
is... We're now in the world of trying to figure out what we should do about unauthorized orders entered by a judge who had no authority over this case until February 2014.
Again, as Your Honor recognized, after Judge McCuskey announced his retirement, the case was reassigned to Judge Baker to preside over the case. He was the only other judge at that time in that courtroom to the extent the case was
sent... But not by the panel originally. That's the problem. I mean, the Central District did what it did, but they should have gone back to the panel.
The Central District purported to assign it to him. It had no more legal effect than the Chicago Tribune assigning it to him.
The only
person with the authority to assign it to him was the panel.
But we felt and...
So why didn't you go back to the panel? That's
because
really the question. You were involved in the case at that point.
I was, Your Honor, and I can tell you the simple answer. If we had gone back to the panel and say, take this away from Judge Baker, let's be realistic, we would have had a very upset couple of judges.
You wouldn't have had to say that. You would have had to say, Judge McCuskey isn't here anymore. It appears that the court thinks Judge Baker can do it. Why don't you consider that?
Well, it may have been deemed by the judges to try and recuse one judge or get away from one judge. Of course, that's the concern, Your Honor. That's the honest
concern. So the better thing is to give it to someone with no power.
And it would have gone back to the
same
judge.
Let me understand if I'm hearing you correctly. You say you didn't ask the panel back in 2010 when Judge McCuskey purported to reassign it because you thought the panel wouldn't approve it. That's extraordinary.
No. What we think would have happened, and again, this same thing applies to plaintiff's counsel. Don't put the burden on us for this. But both sides didn't do anything because the reality was if it had gone back to the panel, they pick a court. They pick the Central District of
Illinois. They pick a judge. The statute could not be clearer.
Okay, fine. So, but to the extent we felt they would send it back to the same court.
We have a problem about what to do, and bluster isn't going to solve our problem. Do you have a position, maybe we have to have separate briefs on this, about what happens when a judge who is not authorized to act in an MDL case nonetheless acts?
What we think should happen is it should be sent back, as opposing counsel said, to Judge Baker, who now has the case. I don't know any other alternative suggested by the law.
Well, the other question that we explored with Mr. Sakharov is whether what the nature of all this authority is, and whether the Judicial Panel on Multidistrict Litigation's later February 2014 order is capable of ratifying things that went on before that order had been issued. I don't know the answer to that question as I sit here, but it seems to me a question.
And I apologize, I don't know the answer to that.
I think what we should do, and I will make this order right now, is invite the parties within 14 days to submit simultaneous memoranda on this question. That, Mr. Sakharov, I assume that's fine?
That's fine, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. So we will hear from you in writing, lest we consume all of the time on this point. So if you would like to turn to the merits of the argument, that would be fine.
Yes, Your Honor. So we think the plaintiffs ignore the key factual findings here, that the issues of injury, causation, and product defect are individualized issues of fact requiring individualized proofs from the extensive record in this case of what happened on these.
Why are they more individualized than the windows in the Pella case?
Well, Your Honor,
some sort of arguments were made that some windows may have been poorly installed, and some, you know, in some instances, you know, you're in a rainy climate or you're not. I mean, there were various differences there too, and we did not find that a reason to refuse certification.
Sure, Your Honor. There's a couple of differences. First of all, that case involved a single specific problem, which was wood rot from water.
So why isn't this a single specific problem? D-225 compliance. People think they're getting a lot of different benefits, maybe 8 different standards from D-225 compliance. But if you've lied about one standard versus lied about standard number 3 or standard number 8, what's the difference?
Well, Judge, first of all, that's not the injury. That's not the complaint. The complaint here is shingles blew off my roof.
Part of the complaint is we thought we bought a really good shingle, and it turns out we bought a mediocre shingle.
Or
a group of shingles with a roof.
But the proof, that's one of the big arguments that Judge Baker recognized and we show in the record here. Their own experts' proof couldn't show, like there was in Pella, a single design defect that affected all the products uniformly. That
it was the failure to comply with D-228 that caused the shingles to absorb too much water, to warp, to misbehave. And Judge Baker did say one thing that I found extraordinary. If I'm remembering him correctly, he said, if you buy a shingle with a 25-year warranty, that doesn't reflect your view that the shingle is going to last for 25 years. And I found that kind of an astonishing assumption.
Well, that's not related to the class certification issue. That wasn't a footnote, Your Honor. But all he's saying there is a warranty might be 25 years long. It just simply means that the company will stand by
and
stand behind its warranty.
They are not going to have to buy a new product for 25 years. But anyway, I mean, the point is that the common question is this D-225 standard, isn't it?
Your Honor, let me give the example of Walmart and show why that is not the right analysis, we believe. In Walmart, the plaintiffs similarly alleged that there was a common issue.
This isn't like Walmart. Walmart is millions of people, all subject to different supervisors. That case was shooting fish in a barrel, actually, in my humble opinion. But
the standard, Your Honor, was not whether there's a common issue, whether these shingles comply with D-225.
But that's a very precise issue that the shingles can be tested for. And, in fact, there's evidence that they don't comply. We're not going to try the merits here at the class certification stage.
Yeah, obviously, Your Honor, we completely disagree that these shingles don't comply with D-225. The issue, though, for the trial court was not to decide who's right. because we think they fully comply in our design.
Specifications
show they comply.
Sure.
But, and that's in the record, all of our specifications show they were designed in accordance with D225. They did some tests. We think their tests were failed, but their tests show that we did not comply with D225.
And the district court accepted both of your experts, as I recall.
Yeah, and he took what they said as true for purpose. Assume their results were right. The point Judge Baker was making, we completely agree, is for each of these different 8 tests, he got different results every time he tested different shingles. 4 of the 8 tests that this expert did, 85 to 99% of the shingles he tested passed.
How is
that a defect?
I have these numbers in front of me, but it seems to me, again, that if a municipality has said we want D2225 compliant shingles to be used within our jurisdiction, they don't mean shingles that fail one of the 8 standards, much less 2 or 3 or 7. So even if the shingles weren't a complete flop, they're still non-compliant, aren't they?
No, Your Honor. That's not the proof.
That is the proof.
No. Your Honor, let me explain. Again, there's a merits issue whether their proof is correct that their test...
Sure, no,
right,
I'm not prejudging.
So the question is, what was their proof of non-compliance with D225? And what they did is when they tested a bunch of old shingles, 12 to 15-year-old shingles, they concluded that they must not have complied 15 years ago when they were designed.
Well, they... No,
the question
now
is,
you're
what,
saying that the acceptance of the testimony is wrong, but here are the numbers that I found in the record from Mr. Rutila. 45% of them met the total net mass criteria. The saturant percentage was met by 36%. The top coating mass by 19%. Top surfacing mass, you're doing well on, 99%. Dry felt mass, 98%. And then a couple of different sieve measures. And then Mr. Rutila concludes that the overwhelming majority have problems with underweight top coating, excessive fine mineral matter in the surfacing, and underweight asphalt saturant. So he finds some common ground, but I'm not even sure that's important. The shingles are still non-compliant, even if they fail one test.
Okay, let me accept everything you just said, Your Honor, is true. It doesn't get around the causation problem. In other words, what happened on these plaintiff's roofs? If I take the deposition of the plaintiff, and he says, I said, what happened? What's your problem with your shingles? Plaintiff Height testifies, they blew off my roof after a storm. It's still going to be an individualized issue of fact. Was that because of some non-compliance with D225? We had a couple granules missing on the top of that shingle? If that was the non-compliance, 99% of our shingles passed that standard, one didn't, and had a couple granules. Was that the cause of the injury?
No, I understand that. Comcast itself, though, indicates that Rule 23 doesn't require a plaintiff seeking certification to prove that every element of the claim is susceptible of class-wide proof. You need a common question of law or fact, 23A, and you also need that question to predominate. Now, I will say one thing that I think is interesting to look for is whether, if that question is answered one way at the trial, the case is over. If it's answered the other way, perhaps there'll be additional proceedings. If this is certified and you persuade at trial, assuming hypothetically there's a trial, I know about the settlement statistics, but suppose, you would win if you could show, and you would preclude every single claim like this in the country if you could say these complied with D225 and that was the theory. Of course, if you lose on that, then there'd be additional proceedings and there'd be some people you might be able to show simply have no claim at the later stage. But this is one of these knock it out altogether in one direction kinds of cases.
Your Honor, if we accepted what you just proposed, they can just simply get up here and say, which is what they've done, General Motors does not comply with industry standards.
But that's not what we've done. We have a record here. People are taking very seriously, as they must, what the Supreme Court has said about the need to put proof in the record. You don't just do it on a 12B6 kind of approach. You had your expert. They had their expert. you know, there's a lot of material that the judge had to look at.
And the judge concluded from that material that it wasn't common proof, Judge.
But that this was the generic conclusion.
This generic concept of didn't comply with D225. There's tons of tests under D225. They found 8. We say the proof, even from, and we gave many examples, even from the named plaintiff's roof, when you looked at the shingle level, what this expert tested, he didn't even get the same results on the same roof. 2 shingles, he would say failed the test. But 2 shingles from that same plaintiff's roof passed the same test. Over and over and over, we put evidence into the record, and the judge found that. He couldn't even get the same results for the same plaintiffs. So how can you extrapolate, because you test one shingle and you found it failed this standard, you test this shingle, it failed this standard, then make a conclusion or extrapolate.
They aren't different standards, though. They're subsets of D, and you didn't do the D228 testing.
That's completely false. We produced thousands of test results.
D228 testing?
Yes. Your Honor, it's in the record. We produced the documents. They've said that from day one in this case, and from day one, we have vehemently denied that. We've cited the deposition testimony. We've produced the documents. We've cited them by record. We consistently did all those different components of D228 on a daily basis during the production process.
Yeah, I thought you were saying you did the equivalent of D228 as opposed to actual test.
We do each, just like their expert did during his testing. He picked a few and tested. We do each of the tests, but we do them during the production. You don't do them after they're made, tear them all apart. You do the saturation test, the top coating test. That's the debate. They say we didn't do it.
Mr. Ricketts testified, your expert, that he found no evidence that you would ever use that test.
He had never done the test which requires you to take them out of the wrappers and then break them down and do each test. He testified clearly. He did each of the tests during the production. That's how companies make shingles. They test while they make them. They don't test them afterwards.
Why? Why? The standard appears to contemplate testing of completed tiles. Now, maybe your client's position is we're entitled to certify compliance even though we just disagreed with it and did something else. But if that's what's in the standard, that's what's in the standard. And it seems very strange for your client to say, well, we just had a different view. We didn't do what the standard said, and then we certified that we had.
No, Your Honor. We think the test requires for D2.
I'm sure your client thinks that what he did is better or just as good or something like that, but it isn't what the standard said. I think that's what Mr. Isaac said.
There's an issue of
undisputed.
Fact.
Undisputed.
Yeah, it is disputed that we did not comply with
that's
D2,
a different.
2,
you're
5.
Using a different word, though.
There's two different issues.
You didn't do the test.
So there's two questions. We did do each of the tests that are required for D225 compliance. We didn't do the longer D228
test. That's the point. Okay, thank you very much.
Let me ask one more question. Is there a difference between the compliance and what happened to the shingle once it was installed? That is blowing off, improperly installed or anything. Is there any relationship there, or is it just a compliance issue?
We think even if the shingles theoretically, which we disagree, didn't comply, it wasn't the cause of the plaintiff's injuries. Their problems were independent. There's no causal link. Let's say, give the example again. We didn't have we had a little bit less asphalt, like their expert found, maybe 1% less asphalt than is needed. That's not going to prove that anyone had any shingle problems later on. They never linked. In fact, their expert, and this is critical, specifically testified when we asked the question, and his answer was, it's certainly possible that his test results showing noncompliance with D225, his test results were caused by normal weathering, not any defect in the shingle. That's page 71 of his deposition.
Mr. Rutila also opined that the defects he identified did cause shingles exposed to weather to fail prematurely because of excessive moisture retention.
He said that could happen, but it could also be weather. That's the key. The causation issue could not be established with common proof, Your Honor.
Retention is different.
That's what's in... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
But that's what's in individualized.
Exactly. That's the problem. He couldn't link his D225 theory with any injury of any class member. He had a theory, but when we went to the plaintiff's homes and we looked and we took investigations, we pulled the shingles and looked at them and examined them, It turned out it was a completely different story. It had nothing to do with D-225.
Okay. I think we have your point now, unless there are further questions from either of my colleagues.
Thank you.
Now, your time ran out, Mr. Sakharov, but I will give you another minute.
Three very quick points, Your Honor. In the record, the question was put to Mr. Ricketts, their expert. In this litigation, have you seen any document from 1979-2008 where ICAO performed ASTM D-228 testing to verify that the shingles met D-225 at the time of manufacture? Answer, I have not. That is on page 7 of our class certification brief. That is confirmed by Andrew Lodge, their 30B6 expert. They never performed D-228. On the question of whether this is susceptible to class-wide proof of damages, count 4 of our complaint is a breach of contract. You warranted, you represented that this was D-225 compliant. It was not. D-225 gets a premium price in the market. You are not entitled to that premium because you lied about the goods you delivered. That is susceptible to class-wide proof. And finally, our expert, Dean Killa, and this is cited at page 6 of our memorandum in support of class certification, says that the shingles failed, did not conform to D-225, and these are his words, with overwhelming consistency, and that this is why the shingles failed in application. That is our class.
I'm sorry, what do they mean by failed in application? Did they deteriorate quicker?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor, there are pictures throughout.
So you have a deterioration problem, but we don't address the issue. That doesn't address the issue of shingles blowing off when they shouldn't have blown off, that sort of thing, right?
It does, Your Honor, because it compromised. The testimony from Dean Rutila, who's an expert on roofing materials, is that this compromised the structural integrity of them and led to their degradation. There are pictures throughout the record of the shingles waving, looking like sand dunes or something, and having nonconformity to, again, I'm not an expert in this, but I have a home and I have a roof and I like it to be kind of level and keep the water out, and this one was neither level nor kept the water out for the warranted period of time. That's the class-wide proof that this was susceptible to harm. This is just like Pella, and also, if I one more case, in Metcoil, this court distinguished between the class-wide definition of the harm and what might be legally compensable damages down the road. So it may be that some class members don't have legally compensable damages under the make whole as opposed to the delta in the purchase price theory. That may be. But this court has anticipated that in Metcoil, in Pella, in Butler. This was the entire issue in Butler. This is what the cert issue was to the Supreme Court in Butler about whether that states a viable class action. And this court said yes, and the Supreme Court denied cert on that. Thank you very much,
Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case.